Thanks for tuning in for the November the 3rd podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology, Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. This week's feature interview is a discussion on the pattern of treatment response in patients with idiopathic generalized epilepsy and whether clinical and neurophysiological parameters can help predict who will respond to these treatments. In the other segment, you'll hear a discussion on dissociated motor learning in functional gait disorders.
Hi, this is Derek Bauer at the University of Virginia. I'm here with Christoph Bayer to talk about his paper, Patterns and Prognostic Markers for Treatment Response in Generalized Epilepsy. So let's kick off with going over the overall basic findings of your paper.
Sure. Maybe I start with the unique setting we have at our university hospital. We are located on Iceland Fjung, in the middle of Denmark, and we have one department and we are treating patients with long-term follow-up in many decades now. So we have a very unbiased cohort. And in this study, when looking back in the last year, we found that generalized epilepsies, they are benign. At the end, about 90% get seizure-free, but they are difficult to treat. We need an average of 2.6 anti-epileptic drugs to get patients seizure-free and free of side effects. The second main message is that the sub-syndrome matters. So the odds of treatment response, they differ substantially depending on the sub-syndrome. And the third key point is that we didn't find any clinical characteristics which may help us to choose which drug may be best for the patient.
That's great. So take me back to the 2.6 medications. That seems like quite a lot to get someone on the right medication. Is that mostly related to tolerability or efficacy, or is it a mixture of both?
It's a mixture of both. What we found is an inverse correlation between efficacy and side effects. So the more effective the drug is, the more side effects does it have. And this gives challenges in daily treatment and does make the retention rate pretty similar between all drugs.
Understood. So you also mentioned that it depended on the sub-syndrome. So any particular sub-syndromes that were easier to treat relatively than others, or were there more difficulties with medications that made it more difficult depending on the syndrome?
Of course, there was a difference between sub-syndromes, but this is long known. We found the same pattern of response. So in all sub-syndromes, in JME, in absence epilepsy, in epilepsy with generalized tonic-clonic seizures alone, we found that valproic acid was the most effective drug and lamotrigine was the least effective one. And levetiracetam was kind of in the middle. But these differences were most pronounced in the JME subtype. So we have pretty impressive odds ratios. For example, valproic acid was almost 8 times more likely to give seizure freedom in patients with JME. The ratio for levetiracetam as compared to lamotrigine was 2.5. When looking at epilepsy with generalized tonic-clonic seizures alone, these differences didn't even get statistically significant. And again, JME was kind of in the middle.
So it sounds like valproic acid may be a good drug for juvenile myoclonic epilepsy. Would you say that's fair to say?
Valproic acid is the most effective drug for JME, yes, definitely. But you have also be aware of the side effects. You get weight gain. It's well known that women must not take this drug if they want to get pregnant due to the risk to the fetus. And there are several other problems, hair loss, for example, associated with valproic acid. So it's difficult.
So it sounds like when we're considering a medication in these situations, there's a balance that has to be considered. Is there any reason to pick lamotrigine over Depakote or Keppra based upon your data?
I think it's, again, about the sub-syndrome. I think if you have a patient with generalized tonic-clonic seizures alone, I would certainly choose lamotrigine because you have a high rate of treatment control, not as high as with valproic acid, but reasonable, and a very low risk of side effects. In contrast, if you're looking at JME or at absence epilepsy, you may consider levetiracetam, which is kind of in between the two. But you shouldn't be reluctant to use valproic acid, especially in a patient where you have difficult to treat seizures, if this is what the patient needs.
Interesting. You also mentioned a moment ago briefly about the women's health considerations with valproate. Would that also suggest that the other two medications you studied may be better considerations from a women's health perspective?
Definitely. We have a very extensive data for lamotrigine that it doesn't harm the fetus in a pregnant woman. The data is getting increasingly better for levetiracetam. On the other hand, we have very convincing data that valproic acid is among the most dangerous drugs for the children that are in the mother's stomach.
So kind of taking your paper as a whole, how did the findings change your clinical management of patients with generalized epilepsy?
In Denmark, we've been very reluctant to use valproic acid, maybe too reluctant due to the mentioned problems. And I use it now more frequently. But of course, it's always the individual decision. But sometimes seizure freedom is more important for an individual patient, for example, if they're very dependent on the driving license and maybe they do not consider pregnancy at all. On the other hand, if you have a young woman who wants to get pregnant, I would even try lamotrigine if they suffer JME, because it's the best drug, after all, we know, for pregnancy.
Those are all really good points. In thinking through this data, are there any points of wisdom that you would give to prescribers in treating generalized epilepsy? Any things that they should think about when they're writing that first prescription for a patient when they get diagnosed?
I would definitely recommend to talk with the patient about this inverse association of efficacy and side effects. So there's no free lunch, if you can say this. And it's always an individual assessment depending on the patient needs. As mentioned, sometimes seizure freedom is the most important to complete college, to drive, to work, or whatever. Important in other conditions, you would certainly avoid the side effects of valproic acid. So I guess there is no one fits all, but I hope that our data will help the prescribers to find an optimal treatment. And I definitely really hope that future patients do not have to try 2, 3, 4 antiepileptic drugs before they get seizure free, and that our data help to accelerate this process.
Speaking of those adverse events, are there any in particular that we should be warning our patients about with these medications that, you know, were particularly common or that could be particularly problematic?
In our study, we didn't find unexpected side effects. We had a few patients with allergic reactions to lamotrigine. This is something in our hands, some 5 to 10% of the patients, we found tiredness and some kind of aggressiveness with levetiracetam. Also for valproic acid, it's mainly weight gain and hair loss, which are the main problem in our hands, sometimes some liver dysfunction.
So as we conclude, you compared 3 different seizure medicines, and it sounds like there's a lot of factors that have to be considered between the epilepsy syndrome type and the risk of side effects. Are there any other considerations that prescribers should consider in their choice of medication?
I think you mentioned the most important things. So the sub-syndrome and the patient situation is crucial. And when looking more scientific on our data, we aimed at finding a biomarker to guide treatment. It would be great to have some kind of EEG changes or whatever that could help us to find this patient has to take lamotrigine or this patient will not respond to lamotrigine. So this would make life much easier. But we didn't find this clinical trait to guide our treatment, although we tried in a very large cohort of more than 300 patients. Think which drug to choose in which situation. As mentioned, I guess to make the right choice for the patient, I guess you have to look at a sub-syndrome because this will result in a different chance to respond to a given drug. For patients with epilepsy with generalized tonic-clonic seizures alone, the differences between the 3 drugs were minor. They didn't even reach statistical significance. So if you have same efficacy, you choose, of course, the drug with the lowest risk of side effects, which is lamotrigine. When looking at JME, the general chance of responding is lower. So you would focus on seizure freedom, and then you will focus on drugs which give you seizure freedom, which is valproic acid and levetiracetam. Lamotrigine has, in our cohort, only a chance of about 25% to give a sufficient and long-lasting seizure control. So this is not a drug to choose in this constellation. Not mentioning the risk of paradoxical drug reactions like worsening of seizures.
That's great. Thank you for all those wonderful answers, Christoph. I think it was really enlightening highlighting the differences across the different medications in generalized epilepsy. This is Derek Bauer, the University of Virginia. I've been talking with Christoph Bayer on his paper, Patterns and Prognostic Markers for Treatment Response in Generalized Epilepsies.
Hi, this is David Lapidus at the University of Virginia. Today, I'm joined by Diego Caschi. He's a consultant neurologist and professor at University College London Hospital and National Hospital of Neurology and Neurosurgery. We're talking today about his paper that came out in the August issue of Brain called Dissociated Motor Learning and De-Adaptation in Patients with Functional Gait Disorders. Diego, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me to this podcast.
So we were really interested in your article in particular because it spoke about this phenomenon called the broken escalator phenomenon. While we've all felt how it feels weird to step onto an escalator, even though we see it stationary, for it not to start moving all of a sudden, could you just tell us a little bit about what's going on in this phenomenon in our brains?
Sure. So I became interested in the broken escalator phenomenon many years ago, back in 2001, having experienced this myself and wondered why this was happening. So the phenomenon describes that odd sensation and often a physical stumble that is experienced when stepping onto an escalator that's out of order or stationary. And its underlying neurobiology has evolved, our understanding of it has evolved over time. And what we think happens is that when faced with a stationary escalator, the brain has to make some sort of decision. Does it trust the eyes telling you that the escalator isn't moving? Or does it trust the past experience with escalators and assume that it will or could move? And it turns out that most people, about 80% of people experience this phenomenon, use this, what we would call a Bayesian probabilistic method, and decides to go for, well, it could move or it might move approach. And what happens is that you approach the stationary escalator a little faster and leaning forwards a little bit further than you would need if this was a stationary step. So you go for a halfway house, really, of assuming that the escalator could move, even though your eyes are telling you that it most likely will not. And the reason that that seems like a sensible approach is that if you do this, at worst, you will stumble and feel a bit silly. At best, you will avoid falling. And I think that's really the crux of this issue, is that the brain has to decide what the safest option is. And that's the risk assessment that it ends up doing. And that's the reason that, you know, often we feel this sort of weird sensation and stumble when faced with a broken escalator.
And so what exactly causes this phenomenon?
So this is, if you like, a physiological consequence of this computation that the brain does. It is a combination of the prior experience of what we know happens with escalators, that they move, and our current experience. And I think that often there is a range of behaviors that one sees on a broken escalator that range from a very strong physical stumble, where perhaps people rely much more on their past experience of escalators do move, and others who may experience very minimal or no stumble at all, which is where they rely perhaps much more on what they're seeing currently. And from a physiological or kinematic perspective, what happens is that the body is generating a normal response to stepping onto a sled that will propel you backwards. So the idea to avoid falling backwards, which is what would happen if you walked very slowly onto an escalator and didn't prepare for it, one tends to walk a little bit faster and tends to lean forwards. And that is what generates this abnormal physical stumble. And this is what we call the locomotor after effect, which is a learned response. And we learn this in everyday life. This is the reason that we can probe it in a laboratory. We can recreate a broken escalator on the horizontal plane in a laboratory that will induce the same physical stumble and sensation as one experiences in everyday life on the metro or underground.
It's a really incredible niche that you've carved out here. And interestingly, you've found a patient population to apply this to, namely patients with functional gait disorder. So your group found a set of patients with functional gait disorder, some of whom, as we all know, had other functional issues, but you did your best to try and get isolated functional gait disorders. And you compared findings from a group of patients with functional gait disorder versus controls when exposed to this broken escalator phenomenon. And what exactly did you all find?
We compared a group of 14 patients with functional gait disorders to healthy controls. I guess it's useful just to start with a very brief description of what the paradigm consists of. So what we do is we ask individuals to step onto a stationary sled, which are the baseline trials, 5 times. And then we show them what the platform movement looks like when it's on without them stepping onto it. And then we get them to stand on the same platform that was previously stationary and tell them that explicitly, you know, this platform now will move. And so they do 10 trials of stepping onto the moving trial. And then when that's finished, we switch the motors off, we put brakes on the wheels of the sled, and we repeat the first baseline series of trials. So they step onto the stationary platform 5 times. And this is where, in the after trials, where you experience the locomotor after effect. And what we found is that the patients with functional gait disorders, some of whom actually were very disabled and came into our laboratory on a wheelchair for mobility, were fairly surprisingly able to negotiate the moving platform very well. They were much slower walking in the baseline trials, as you might expect, and they had a lot of difficulty sometimes with a simple stepping response. But as soon as the platform was moving, they were able to negotiate that perfectly well, and in fact learned how to step onto the moving platform just like the healthy controls did, so that they had very similar learning curves. So the interesting finding, in a sense, was that they observed the same locomotor after effect that we tend to see in healthy people. But the major difference was that they were unable to revert back to the normal strategy of walking onto the stationary sled. So once they'd experienced the platform moving, they had a locomotor after effect that persisted throughout the after trials when the sled was no longer moving. So most of us who experience this locomotor after effect tend to have this slightly shocked response of, you know, why did I do that? And then immediately after the second trial, you know, you behave just like you did in the very beginning in the baseline trials, where you step onto a stationary sled with no difficulty, no trunk movement, no abnormal sensation. Whereas these patients persisted in their locomotor after effect. And that suggests, in a sense, that they're unable to switch off from this newly learned motor behavior. And that was really the most salient finding. And what I found particularly interesting, in addition to the kinematic measures that we took, we also recorded their subjective instability and anxiety levels across each of the trials before the moving and the after paradigm. And these psychological variables mirrored the motor responses. So they had heightened levels of anxiety and instability during the before trials, where the sled was stationary. And they had much lower, or in fact, normal levels of anxiety and instability during the moving trials, which is very surprising, given that that is the trial that makes you move the most. And then when they came back to the after trials, the sled was stationary again. Again, their levels of anxiety and instability rose. So there's a mirroring of the psychological variables in relation to the motor behavior, which again was, in our mind, quite interesting.
That's really, really fascinating findings. And it's curious, as you mentioned, from the psychological perspective, because that further really drives in the import of the distractibility of these disorders, namely that when the ground is moving under them and facilitating the ambulation, it seems like their stress level went down. So again, we're always searching for ways to help this challenging patient population. How do these findings translate clinically into therapeutic approaches that we as neurologists, or we as neurologists referring patients to physical therapists, can help or can recommend for these folks?
So I guess this is the crux of the study, and the main focus of our work is to try and make something that's translatable and actually clinically applicable. Globally, our data show that patients with functional gait disorders have the ability to learn novel motor tasks, but what they find most difficult is to unlearn established motor behaviors. And that's what causes this perpetuation of the inappropriate movements for that context. Our findings show that it is possible for these patients to improve baseline gait performance. And in fact, their gait velocity increased substantially, having been exposed to the moving platform. So they learned a new way of walking for the moving platform that then allowed them to walk much more normally in the after trials. And their gait velocities compared to the before, when they, you know, when they came into the lab, increased substantially. So there's a suggestion that even in that immediate setting, they're able to alter their walking behaviors. And the question really is whether that can be something that will remain the case in the more chronic phase, whether you require more interventions than a single event. And I suspect the answer to that is yes. So I think that from a practical perspective, it's perhaps using these implicit motor learning strategies where patients have less conscious control over their motor behavior. And the broken escalator paradigm is particularly good for this because the stakes are so high. You know, if you get this wrong, you'll fall. And that really means that there's little scope for conscious, voluntary control over the motor behavior. It's too fast to do that. And therefore, this really allows reflexive and implicit motor learning strategies to emerge. And that's really the fundamental aspect of physical therapies for these individuals, I think.
Really interesting. And recently, a neuropsychologist in our group presented us a movie. I can't remember where it was from, but it was of a physical therapist putting a patient with functional gait disorder on a treadmill. And now we really are starting to understand the substrate that's involved in why this mechanism might be helpful. So really phenomenal to hear that even the folks that were enrolled in your study may have had temporary, if not persistent, improvement in their gait just from participation. So what's the next step for your research, or perhaps a bigger picture in the field of functional gait disorder or functional neurologic disorders in general, to gain meaningful therapeutic interventions for these folks?
So our next step really is to try and explore the use of these implicit versus explicit movement strategies that may actually help not just for the diagnosis of these patients, but also potentially have therapeutic value. As for many other functional movement disorders, I think the key is to develop a physical training program that can tap into implicit behaviors. And that potentially could help overcome some of the more explicit motor actions that they have, which is ultimately what is causing their greatest disability in their day-to-day. And it's targeting those behaviors, those implicit motor behaviors, within a cognitive model of motor control that for me is key. So I think the more one is able to distract the individual away from the motor task at hand, the more likely it is for that individual to unlearn these abnormal movements. And from a gait and balance perspective, I think something like the broken escalator paradigm actually could have therapeutic value. It's a very simple piece of equipment. You know, it's just a sled on a motor, so it's not that difficult to do. And, you know, potentially this is something that could be done with adaptation on a treadmill. So I think it offers the possibility for the therapeutic intervention, and that's really where we want to take this further forward.
Wonderful. Again, I've been speaking with Diego Caschi on his paper, Dissociated Motor Learning and De-Adaptation in Patients with Functional Gait Disorders, published in August in Brain. Diego, thank you so much for joining us today. I learned a lot.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.